Okay, colleagues,
members of the audience, welcome. Thank you for being with us this Friday morning. What are we? We're the last day of May, May 31st, 2013. This is the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development, and we are going to be spending the bulk of today talking about athletics here in the state of Oregon. And we're really looking forward to that, athletics, both in our public higher ed schools and our private higher ed schools. This should be very, very interesting. Before we do that, though, we have some business to do. We have a work session on Senate Bill 782, so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 782. Vice Chair Harker.
Chair Demarest, I move Senate Bill 782A without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Rules.
Vice Chair Harker moves Senate Bill 782A without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Rules. And before we get into discussion, colleagues, let me just explain what we're doing here. We had a very good hearing on Wednesday. Got some good public testimony from affected parties, and it became clear to me, I think clear to all of us, that the best route to go on this apprenticeship issue is to form a work group, a task force, to deal with this issue in the best, most effective manner possible. We have received Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments that would accomplish that. Those amendments, in my belief, are close to being something that everybody could be happy with, but not quite there. And so we're sending this to Rules with the sole purpose of getting it right. I intend to reconvene the group that met a couple of weeks ago, just to make sure that we've got all the elements exactly as they need to be, and I have a promise from leadership that this will be moved through the Rules Committee very quickly and then onto the floor. So that is the purpose of this amendment, and I'd be happy to entertain any discussion.
To this motion, yes.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your words about wanting to find a consensus pathway forward on this issue regarding apprenticeship. It would be my opinion and my feeling, and I think the vast majority of the folks that testified in front of our committee on Wednesday, that the Dash 6s are in fact a consensus way forward that is a clear pathway to success, I believe, on this issue that would create a task force patterned after the CMGC task force that came out of the 2011 session that was bicameral, bipartisan, labor, contractors, everybody working together, and that my understanding is that the Dash 6s, and I believe there is a letter, is that correct? Did we receive a letter from them signed and stamped by, I think, all of the participants that stating that, in fact, the Dash 6s would be their preferred pathway forward. So I would just respectfully put that out there for members to consider, and I'll allow other members to weigh in as they choose to.
Thank you. And I will just say that I have had individuals come to me and say, whatever you do, don't make it like the CMGC process. So, you know, what people say publicly and what people say privately is often quite different. And I think my experience with this issue to date has shown to me why perhaps a bill might have passed very easily on the Senate side and then came to us and blew up. And my goal is to keep that from happening. And that's why that's why I'm pursuing this course. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Been busy with a couple of other things the last 48 hours, but I've tried to stay on top of this, and I thought I had talked to maybe not Mr. Metzger, but pretty much everybody else as we had crafted the Dash 6 and a letter of support. I guess I'm a a little bit shocked coming in this morning. I thought we had a Dash 6 agreement that we were going to move forward on. A little frustrated, I guess, when we think we have an agreement and then we're talking about moving a bill to another committee. I guess I'm a little lost.
Yes, thank you. Again, you know, let me clarify that, you know, the movement of the bill to the other committee is just for the purpose of making some further tweaks to this bill. We have concerns, I will say, about the fiscal on the bill, and we need to get the fiscal down as close to zero as possible. That's one of the, that will be one of the goals of it. We are going to look at a more aggressive timeline for the work of this committee, or at least for part of the work of the committee, as possible. That, you know, that again is, you know, is what will happen. Again, the core of what is being proposed in these Dash 6s will be maintained. That you have my commitment on that. So, yes, Rick Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was involved in the two-year ago decision to form the work group on the public contracting, and we had no financial impact on that one. We use the committee staff and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I would hope, since we're not all in Ways or in Rules Committee and we have an interest in this, that your side working group includes bipartisan work on that. I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
It certainly will, Representative. Okay, seeing no further discussion, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Forsyth?
Yes.
Representative
Greenland?
Aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Wisman?
No.
Vice Chair Parker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
No.
Chair
Dembrow? Aye. Motion carries. The bill will be sent to rules, and I will keep you all abreast on what's happening with it. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 782 and open an informational hearing on athletics in higher education. Okay. So just a quick background to this. Gosh, I don't even remember when it was, 6 weeks ago or so, we had a hearing where we were talking about the issue of hiring of athletic directors and coaches, you'll remember, and that was a very particular kind of issue. But it led to questions about, so what exactly is the role of athletics in our higher ed institutions? And, you know, is it different for the publics, you know, versus the privates? What are the benefits? What are the costs? You know, et cetera. And so we've scheduled this hearing, and a number of people have generously given their time to come here to us to share their experience with us and expose themselves to our rigorous questioning. So with that, I'm going to call up our first panel is Mike Schell, Mike Green, and Samantha Flett, please. So, should we start with Mike Green? Does it matter? Do you all have a?
We sort of have an order, but it's
okay. No, go do your thing, please.
Good morning, Chair Demsbrill and members of the committee. My name is Michael Schell, and I'm the Director of Athletics at the Institute of Technology, and I've served in that role for the past 11 years. Thank you for this opportunity to provide information about our athletics programs. Especially thank you on behalf of the smaller regional colleges who often feel overshadowed by our larger peers. I'll touch on many areas that will have further detail from other testimonies. I hope today that we can give you an overview beyond the things that you often see in the mainstream media, athletics at an image of athletics at a smaller college and university. Oregon Tech, as well, along with Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon, are members of the NAI, which is the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics. This is a lesser-known organization. It's essentially a smaller version of the NCAA with similar missions. We have a little bit different accountability and rule structures, but all of us strive to educate and develop youth as they move into adulthood. For the regional universities and Oregon Tech, our programs are essentially non-revenue, meaning that they do not generate enough gate receipts, donations, sponsorships to operate on those funds alone. We try to maximize those funds, obviously, but we do rely, on the other funds for scholarships and operating. An example at Oregon Tech, 15% of our budget approximately comes from lottery funds. Because the funding does come from multiple sources, one of the challenges we face in the athletics departments is often that is with reporting. Everyone wants to tie each funding source dollar to a very specific expense, and sometimes those dollars are pooled, and that creates a reporting challenge for us. In the NEI, our travel is focused mostly regional, which is a good thing because that means we're ground transporting across our state. We're eating in local restaurants, we're lodging locally, and in our small communities, and teams travel to us too. When lottery was increased in 2007, one initiative that Oregon Tech implemented was adding a men's soccer program. We did this because we thought that the intent of the money for economic development and education, we could increase access and enrollment, which also would drive some revenue, and we'd also increase some economic development by teams traveling. We discovered in doing this, we helped improve connections with our Hispanic and Latino populations. One student right now is on track to graduate in civil engineering in June, and he came to us from the strawberry fields where him and his family have worked for quite some time. Reductions in funding sources, of course, have significant impact. The regionals and Oregon Tech do not have the opportunities for marketing or donations that some of the larger institutions have. Even what seems like a smaller reduction of $5,000 to $10,000 is a very large number to us. Sports impact enrollment and campus life. Oregon Tech dropped all but two sports in under Measure 5, and what we saw was a plummet of FTE and followed by a very poor campus life and activities were negatively impacted. I was an undergrad student on the campus at that time and witnessed that direct. Recruitment of retention of students is a key component of athletics. Student athletes choose our institution because of the combination of academics and athletics. We did a survey of our students and found that almost every one of them said that. We also found that other students attend our universities because of athletes. An athlete goes to this school and they want to follow their friend. Student athletes are often desirable in the workforce. I was talking to a gentleman that was recruiting for a company, and he indicated that he likes hiring athletes because they tend to have great time management skills. They're missing class all the time. They have to work that out, how to study, when to study. They know how to work as a team. They know how to reduce their stress through physical activity. And in general, they're healthier and such as they're not as much of a burden on their sick time and their health benefit plans. Some of the outcomes we've seen is in my 11 plus years, our program has always combined for over a 3.0 GPA. In the last several years, we've been over a 3.1. Our graduation rates are typically exceed that of the general population. NAI focuses on character development, respect, responsibility, integrity, servant leadership, and sportsmanship is one of our key components. Athletics connects the university with the community. It increases opportunity and access for women. Lottery helps to provide that access, and funds often come donation-wise are specific to men's sport. In conclusion, athletics are a vital component of our universities. They drive enrollment and improve campus life, aid rural economics, and develop well-rounded adults. Thank you. Chair Dembrell, I'm happy to respond to any questions now or any time during the session.
Okay, thank you. Let's hear from the whole panel and then we'll come back.
Okay, hopefully I can work this. There we go. Great. Good morning. For the record, my name is Mike Green and I'm the controller for the Oregon University System. This morning I'll provide an overview of the funding sources for each OUS University's Intercollegiate Athletics Department. Before I delve into the departmental numbers, I thought it would be important to provide some important background information. The scope of Intercollegiate Athletics Departments is shaped by a number of factors, including the size of the institution and its athletics department's conference and divisional affiliations, as well as the number and types of sports fielded. Federal Title IX rules also impact the scope, requiring balance and opportunities for men and women. Additionally, the success of certain sports programs, such as football and basketball, can play an important factor in garnering operating and gift income to fund the departments. The revenue sources shown for each athletics operation include operating revenues, which is made up of ticket sales, gate receipts, concessions, parking, and the like. Student fees, which is the portion of incidental fees that student governments allocate to athletics. Lottery proceeds, which is the allocation of lottery monies to support athletics. Gift grants and booster receipts, which is made up of donations and fundraising proceeds. Royalties and interest, which is income from trademark licensing and interest on cash balances. And institutional fund subsidy, which is fee remissions granted to athletes and or direct funding from the institution. Moving into the institution-specific numbers, Eastern is a member of the Cascade Collegiate Conference of the NAIA. Eastern fields four men's and six women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross-country, and track and field, along with football, softball, and women's soccer and volleyball. The largest source of funding for EOU athletics comes from institutional funds.
Excuse me, Mike.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Rep. Gilliam has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under definition, sorry to interrupt for a second, where does TV money come in?
Let me back up a minute if I can. That would be in operating revenues. So it may not be one of the specific items there, you know, other fee and other sales and fee income. So, mm-hmm. And sponsorship income is similar, but it's in operating revenues.
Follow up. So wouldn't it, depending on what kind of a year you're having and if it's ESPN or ABC or whatever, wouldn't that be the largest possible source?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, perhaps, but I think when we get into, well, we might not have that specific information in the institutional numbers when we look at U of O and Oregon State. It's a big number, but gate receipts, season ticket sales, and the others are pretty large as well, so, okay. And donations as well, depending on.
Thanks.
One other question kind of related to that. So if you have a really successful program, and you can look at OSU and U of O in terms of football as an example, and they bring in a lot of money, like you were alluding to, does any of that money flow back into the university itself, or does it all stay on the sports side?
Representative Dembrough, Representative Gorsuch, typically it stays in the athletics department.
Okay.
And in the case of Oregon State University, their athletics department revenue, which we'll see in a minute, mm-hmm. does not cover the full cost of the athletics department.
Really?
That's correct.
Okay.
So they are receiving institutional funds. Now that, I believe, will change with the advent of the Pac-12 conference media revenues that we're seeing come in. So
Okay. This
is fiscal 12 numbers. Fiscal 13, I think we'll see a little different picture there. And I know they have a plan to eliminate the institutional fund subsidy over time at Oregon State.
Okay.
At University of Oregon, they do not have an institutional fund subsidy for their athletic department.
Mm.
And I believe they have a plan to begin putting money back into the university from their athletics department out of some of these revenues. But
great.
I think I answered your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and again, when you say that money stays with the athletic department, it doesn't necessarily stay with that particular sport, but it's used to subsidize other sports as well. Is that right?
Representative Denver, that is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Let's see, the largest source of funding for Eastern Athletics comes from institutional funds, which makes up 49% of total athletics resources. The second largest is student fees at 28%, lottery proceeds comprises 13%, and operating revenues, gift grants and booster receipts and royalties and interest make up the rest. Of the total resources at Eastern, they spend about $344,000 on athletic student financial aid. Moving to OIT, Oregon Tech is also a member of the Cascade Collegiate Conference of the NAIA. They field 6 men's and 7 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross country, golf, soccer, and track and field, along with softball, baseball, and women's volleyball. The largest source of funding for Oregon Tech Athletics is from institutional funds, making up 39% of total athletic resources. Oregon Tech garners its second largest source of funding, 22% from operating revenues. Student fees is the next largest at 18%. Lottery proceeds comprise about 15%, which is the next largest. And gift grant and booster receipts, royalties and interest comprise the remainder. Of those total resources, Oregon Tech spent about $356,000 on athletic student financial aid. Oregon State University is a member of the Pac-12 Conference of the National Collegiate Athletics Association Division I. OSU fields 7 men's and 10 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, golf, rowing, and soccer, along with football, baseball, wrestling, softball, women's cross country, gymnastics, swimming, track and field, and volleyball. Operating revenues is the largest source of funding for OSU athletics, comprising 54% of total athletics resources. Its second largest is institutional funding at 20%, followed by gifts, grants, and booster receipts at 18%. And student fees, royalties and interest, and lottery proceeds make up the rest. Of those total resources, OSU spent about $8.4 million on athletic student financial aid. PSU is a member of the Big Sky Conference of the NCAA Division I. PSU fields 5 men's and 8 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross country, tennis, and track and field, along with football, softball, women's golf, soccer, and volleyball. At PSU, the institutional fund support for athletics is the largest source of funding at 38%. The next largest is student fees at 30%. Operating revenues comprise 24%. Lottery proceeds, gifts, grants, and booster receipts, and royalties and interest comprise the remainder. Of its total resources, PSU spent about $4.1 million on athletics student financial aid. Like Eastern and Oregon Tech, Southern is a member of the Cascade Collegiate Conference of the NAIA. SOU fields 5 men's and 6 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross country, and track and field, along with football, wrestling, softball, and women's soccer and volleyball. At 44%, student fees is the largest source of funding for SOU athletics. Institutional funds is the second largest at 17%, followed by gifts, grants, and booster receipts comprising 16% of the total. Lottery proceeds and operating revenues make up about 12% of total resources. The remainder is comprised of royalties and interest. Of the total resources, SOU spent about $237,000 on athletic student financial aid. Like OSU, U of O is a member of the Pac-12 Conference of the NCAA Division I. U of O fields 7 men's and 10 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross country, golf, tennis, and track and field, along with baseball, football, softball, acrobatics, and tumbling, and women's lacrosse, soccer, and volleyball. Operating revenues make up 62% of total athletics funding at the U of O. Gifts, grants, and booster receipts comprise some 33% of the total. Student fees, lotteries, proceeds, royalties, and interest make up the rest. U of O athletics does not receive institutional funds. Of its total resources, U of O spent about $9.6 million on athletic student financial aid.
Mike, could I ask you, in terms of the student fees, you know, I noticed that Portland State spends twice as much as U of O on student, the revenue comes from student fees.
Mm-hmm.
How are those decisions made?
Representative Dembro, the decisions are made through a student government process. A student government, and I'm speaking generally because it may be a little different at some campuses than others, but I believe at all campuses, there's a student incidental fee committee that's established by student government, and they work through a budget process. They have presentations from departments to that budget team asking for funding. They work through that process amongst themselves and then submit a proposed budget through student government and up through the university's administration, and then it gets passed that way.
Okay, thank you.
Last but not least, Western is a member of the Great Northwest Athletic Conference of NCAA Division II. Western fields 5 men's and 6 women's sports, including men's and women's basketball, cross country, and track and field, along with baseball, football, softball, and women's soccer and volleyball. Institutional fund support is the largest source of athletics funding at Western, comprising 46% of total athletics resources. Student fees makes up about 24%, with gifts, grants, and booster receipts contributing 14% of total funding. Operating revenues comprise 8%. Lottery proceeds, royalties, and interest make up the rest. Of its total resources, Western spent about $735,000 on athletic student financial aid. And that concludes my prepared comments. If there's any questions or any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions? Yes.
I'd like to follow up on the question about does the surplus in, at the majors, or maybe only U of O and OSU, goes back into the athletic department, but does that reduce the amount of requests from the student activities fees? I mean, is it offset in some way? The contract with PAC, whatever the number is right now, expands a bit. Does that reduce the demand on student activity fee support or basic university support?
Chair Denver, Representative Greenlick, I think it could. I think that process is a deliberative process on the campus, and so I think it will depend upon, and it depends upon, some of the decisions made by the student leadership. And I need to point out also that certainly at U of O and Oregon State, that student fee decision has some impact by student tickets that are made available to students to attend athletic events. And I know very directly at University of Oregon, it is tied, at least it used to be. It's been a few years since I looked at the details, so I would say that I haven't looked at it lately. But there was pretty much an exchange transaction. You know, student fees goes to U of O athletics in exchange for a certain number of student tickets at football and men's basketball and other events. So,
can I follow that?
Yes, please.
Well, some people seem concerned. In fact, we had a letter to the committee today talking about it, that the very rich program, like the football program at U of O, doesn't produce enough revenue so that university funds and student activity funds, although student activity funds is a decision of the students, but university funds that might be going to other university functions are going into still supporting an athletic program. An athletic program that seems pretty rich. I mean, you know, creating big buildings for student athletes only and other kinds of things. Do you have a sense of the balance? And I understand why Eastern Oregon needs aid. I understand why Southern Oregon needs aid. But I'm not sure I understand why U of O and OSU particularly need aid. And what's the level of that aid? You had on your slide, I think, for the universities.
Chair Denver, Representative Greenlick, I think perhaps I'm not the best to answer that question. I guess I'm the bean counter, and those decisions are made, you know, in a campus.
You just count the beans wherever they go.
Exactly. So I guess I would say I'm not the best to answer that question, but I do believe that it is an open, deliberative process that the student fee committees do make those choices and make those decisions in a process that where there's the athletics department presents a request and there's a deliberative process over why they need it and how it's what it's to be used for. So
that's not true of general university funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, that's correct.
All Colleagues, actually, I hadn't realized that we'd received a letter. I don't know if you've seen it, Victoria, but we got a letter this morning from someone from the University of Oregon Faculty Senate, and we'll put it in OLIS. A resolution that they that the Faculty Senate passed, suggesting that the U of O president require the U of O athletic department to pay from its budget the full cost of providing tutoring and academic support for student athletes and a number of other elements. So we'll put that up, and it came too late for us really to consider it. Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to get too far afield and make you answer the big picture questions. I appreciate what Representative Greenlee brought up. Just to get back to my original question, I would appreciate if at some point you could follow up, and I'd like a little more detail on that, particularly the big TV money, for lack of a better way to say it. And I'm sure it ebbs and flows, you know, regarding ratings and success of football team or basketball team. But I think it's a significant impact. In many ways, it's bigger than we are. It's bigger than the state of Oregon is, but I think it's significant. I'd love to see some detail of how that's impacted budgets at specific universities over time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Devereaux, Representative Gilliam, I'm happy to provide that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's move on to Samantha. Samantha, thank you very much for coming.
Good morning, everybody. Chair Dembrough. My name is Samantha Flett, and I am an Eastern Oregon University alumni with a degree in Media Arts and Communications. I am currently a graduate assistant for the women's basketball program at Eastern while I complete my master's degree in business administration. I cannot tell you how honored I am to be speaking to all of you today about this very important piece of legislature that is Title IX. Even though Title IX has been around for 40 years, there are still a large number of misconceptions as to what it is and how it is implemented. Title IX states that exclusion from participation in any educational program that receives federal financial assistance on the basis of sex is prohibited. Although that definition covers a vast number of areas, one of the biggest areas that has seen an impact from Title IX has been athletics. I am here today to discuss with you the impact Title IX has had on Eastern Oregon University and me personally. Title IX focuses only on educational institutions that receive federal funds. In order to be seen as compliant, schools must focus on three things, which are participation opportunities, scholarships and financial aid, and benefits. Eastern has been extremely fortunate in the past 30 years to have athletic directors and presidents who have been passionate about Title IX, and they've made sure EOU has been ahead of the curve when it comes to compliance. According to Title IX, you can have a 1% deviation between the proportionality, and Eastern Oregon falls in that 1%. When it comes to providing opportunities, Eastern sponsors six female sports and one support program for women. That means that 6 out of the 10 intercollegiate sports offered at Eastern are women's teams. EOU will continue to conduct interest surveys to see where interest lies to create additional opportunity. The last survey was taken in 2004, so hopefully we can get one in there again. When it comes to the benefits within Title IX, there's a list of things that can apply to. Eastern meets in this category in ways such as equity within coaches' salaries, facilities, budgets, equipment, and much more. When it comes to Title IX, my generation is seeing the payoff of years of hard work that has been done by trailblazers who came before us. For example, when Title IX was first established in 1972, my mother was actually, that was the year she was born. So the Title IX is not something that I think of on a daily basis, and I attribute that to the amazing strides that have been taken over the past 40 years. But in preparing for this presentation, I had a chance to reflect on Title IX and what it has really meant in my life, and I realized it has more of an impact than ever imagined. I literally would not be where I am today without this piece of legislature. I grew up in a single-parent household on the Spokane Indian Reservation in Washington. My whole life, I loved basketball, and I now realize it is because of Title IX that I was afforded the right to play. I managed to make my way to EOU, being given scholarship money to attend, but without that financial assistance, I'm not sure that I would have ever been able to not only attend college, but graduate while playing the sport that I love. And thanks to Title IX, I not only received my undergraduate degree, but have been given the opportunity to receive my master's degree, being a graduate assistant for the women's basketball program. I realized Title IX not only affected my life, but the lives of so many around me. Throughout my basketball career, I had only female coaches, but never before did I give a second thought. But I realized that these coaches got where they are today because of Title IX. The athletic world that has not only seen a huge leap in the number of female coaches and administrators, but are now to the times where second and third generations of Title IX trailblazers are involved in sports. This is truly a special time to be a female athlete. I've learned so much through my interactions and involvement in athletics. Athletics provides everyone the avenue to develop self-esteem, confidence, leadership skills, discipline, and forge lifelong relationships. As long as those who have greatly benefited from Title IX continue to play active roles and remain diligent in making sure that the rules are followed, I'm sure the success of Title IX will continue to grow, and I am excited to hear the testimonies of those people who have benefited from Title IX as it celebrates its next 40 years. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Samantha. Yes, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, as you know, I'm very shy, and I hate to dominate the questions today. But Representative Gallegos doesn't really get going until
about 9:30. You have to make up for those days you missed.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here. That was a wonderful, refreshing testimony to hear. I appreciate it. We're all reeling a little bit. I know you didn't intend to insult us, but your mom was born in 76.
But yes,
we're getting over it. But I just thought that was what a great story you have, and I appreciate
Thanks.
It very much. We obviously, when we talk about Title IX, athletics comes up, but in your testimony you mentioned it's for all academic programs. And I would just say, Mr. Chair, as a source of pride, former Representative Edith Green was probably the driving force behind Title IX. She represented parts of Portland in Congress for 20 years, and she actually got the title of Mrs. Education. That's kind of sexist or something. But anyway, she was Mrs. Education as a result of her work on Title IX. So we have a great heritage here in Oregon, in her and in you. And I wanted to make that point. Mr. Chair, there might be an opportunity for a statue of Edith Green at some point. But I would recommend it next session.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much for your story.
Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Gilliam. Yeah, I'm sure Portland State would love to have that statue. But
there is one in the Capitol.
Yeah.
No.
So I have a question related to that, Mike. You know, you talked about the number of sports at each university fields, and I wasn't recording the numbers exactly, but it seemed that in most schools there are actually more women's teams than men's teams. Is that right? And could you explain that, how those decisions are made?
I think I can, and I have to say that I'm not.
Or perhaps the other Mike can help us with that too. But
was a good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not an expert, but I believe it has to do with the fact that if you field a football team, there's, you know, 70 players or whatever, and so then in order to have equity on the women's sports side, we have to have more sports to make up for that. I believe that's what the result is.
Mm-hmm. Michael, does that?
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, sure.
Got it right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Other questions, colleagues?
Real quick.
Rep. Wisnant, then
Rep.
Torsett.
Thank you, Mr. Does any of the funds go into supporting intramural programs from this, or is that
so? Representative Denver, Representative Wisnant, I believe so. I believe in many of the athletic departments, intramural are part of it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And student fees also help with intramural programs, I think,
right.
Yes. Rep. Gorsuch?
Great testimony. In terms of the Title IX efforts at EOU, which sounds very impressive, can anybody tell me if the rest of the OUS system is on a par with that? Are they all similarly good programs, or are there some that need to work on it?
I wouldn't be able to answer that.
Chair Demro, Representative Gorsuch. At Oregon Tech, we don't have football, and so that in itself lends us to be more closer to Title IX. There are always challenges at the universities, and they constantly evaluate them. Each university will have a specific person outside of athletics that's designated to look at that issue every year, and we file an annual report with the federal government.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm.
Great. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much, all three of you. Okay, I'll call up our second panel. We have Matt Sayre from Southern Oregon, Ty Howland from Portland State, and Roger Thompson from U of O. Thank you. Pick your poison.
I think I'm batting leadoff. Is that
yep.
right?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Well, good morning.
Yes, great to see you again. Right?
Yeah, nice to see you, Chair Demro, and the rest of the committee. It's always nice to be in Salem and in the People's House, and as a native Oregonian, it's fun to be back and have Hillsborough represented in this group, too, my hometown. I wanted to share just a few comments.
You have to give us your name. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Roger Thompson, Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Oregon. And so I thought I would take just a few moments to share with you and address one of the questions that was brought up earlier, which is the impact that athletics has on other parts of the university. From my standpoint, as the person responsible for enrollment at the University of Oregon, there are many contributing factors that impact enrollment. But we cannot understate the value of tens, if not hundreds of millions of people viewing Oregon athletics on a fall Saturday. The type of exposure that the University of Oregon receives from playing in a BCS game is an example, is exposure that we certainly could not afford to pay for on our own. The impacts of athletics around enrollment have been well documented. Some of the best research studies began with something that in my business we commonly refer to as the Flutie factor. In the 1980s, Doug Flutie was a quarterback at Boston College playing on national television against Miami University. He heaves a pass as time's running out, dramatic catch in the end zone, application spike by nearly doubling in a very short period of time. Now, there's lots of things that folks at Boston College might attribute that to, but my colleagues there certainly feel that one impact was that play, the excitement around it, and the fact that it was replayed for years and years and years afterwards. It brought Boston College into the national media consciousness. Not that they weren't already there, but maybe more so. The data point that I like to share is over the last 5 years at the University of Oregon, we've seen our freshman applications grow by 89%. Now, when you consider that high school graduates in the state of Oregon are actually flat or decreasing through the end of the decade, that's significant growth to grow by 89% over a five-year period. How much of that is attributable to athletics? Is very difficult for us in social science to get to a cause and effect kind of relationship. We also spend money to advertise on websites for high school students and their parents that get a million hits a month. I think that contributes also. We visit high schools in the city of Portland. Now we're up to four times a year. I think that contributes. But athletics is a contributing factor, and it's a positive. The other example I like to use about this is the year we went undefeated in football. That year we saw a huge application increase from Pennsylvania. That's not an area where we concentrate resources. It's not a place where we send our staff to go recruit. So if we were going to try to attribute what that might be or why that growth was happening, I think athletics would be a reasonable conclusion to draw. In terms of the impact, when we talk about applications as an example, 89% growth generates significant revenue from our application pool over the past 5 years. That revenue goes into general university funds and is provided has provided services for students across a growing a wide span of areas at the university. So I think athletics is a contributing factor. The publicity is valuable, and it's helpful to us from an enrollment standpoint, because many times our job at the University of Oregon is to help students who may know the U of O only through fall Saturdays. It's our job to make sure they know what happens Monday through Friday. And so it provides a great window to the institution. It provides us an opportunity to talk about the outstanding academic breadth and depth of our institution and the type of experiences that young people would have if they came to the University of Oregon. So the amount that it contributes is difficult to actually quantify specifically, but we certainly believe it's incredibly valuable and helpful to other parts of our institution. I'll let my colleagues speak. Or answer questions, however you want to do it.
What do we hear from all of you? Thank you, Roger.
You bet. Okay. Thank you, Representative Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Matt Sayer. I'm the athletic director at Southern Oregon University. And as my colleagues spoke to it, we have 11 programs at Southern Oregon University. We have five men's and six women's. We do have football. We are a member of the NAIA, the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, and it's very distinct from the NCAA. Distinct, not better, but different. And the OIT and Eastern Oregon are also NAIA members and in the Cascade Conference, so we compete against them. And the NAIA schools in the state fill a very different niche than our larger NCAA brothers. And that niche, if you look at Southern Oregon University, we have about 414 student-athletes on campus. Those 414 student-athletes make up about 10% of the student body. Each one of those student-athletes averages about $800 of athletic aid each, and that's about it. So they're not getting full rides to come to Southern Oregon University, Eastern Oregon, OIT. They're there for the love of the sport. They're there for to be on an intercollegiate athletic program and to get their degrees. That's the primary reason they are there. They because we don't have a whole lot of athletic aid that we give out, our coaches look for those student athletes to recruit that have a high grade point average, have high ACT and SAT scores, so those student athletes can access the academic scholarship pool that the university offers. Our coaches are pretty good at it, too. Our grade point average with these 400 student-athletes right now is at a 3.02. We'll see how spring term comes in, but we're optimistic. And we do have football, by the way. I did mention that, right? those 414 student-athletes are a very good source of revenue for SOU. They retain and graduate at a rate about 10% higher than the regular student body. And so for the university, it's a good bet to invest in athletics and count on that enrollment and that graduation and that revenue from those student-athletes. The support that we give to those student-athletes, I was charged with talking about support for academic support for student-athletes and the compliance methodology. The support that we give to our student-athletes is not much different than what we give to the regular student body. We don't have the revenue, we don't have the resources available to us to provide private tutors, nor private classes for student-athletes in study skills, that kind of thing. Basically, our student-athletes have the same access to TRIO programs, academic advising, things of that nature that the regular student body does. Now, we work really hard as coaches and administrators to ensure that our student-athletes are aware of those resources and access them when they can. The great thing about Southern Oregon University is we've got a student-to-faculty ratio of about 17-1. So all of our faculty members on campus know when there is a student-athlete in their class. We ask our student-athletes to ensure that they go up and talk to the faculty member the first week of school, introduce themselves, talk about them being on an intercollegiate team, provide the faculty member with a travel schedule that will outline days that they may miss classes, and start the process there with the faculty member of identifying themselves. We also send out a couple of electronic grade checks every term, and our faculty are great about responding back to those that also identify student athletes in their classes. It's a great support network. I get a telephone call, or a head coach will get a telephone call if a student athlete is not doing well in a class or is missing classes. Sometimes to the chagrin of the student athlete, because then the coach has a meeting with that student athlete and we take care of things. The other great thing about the NAIA is it allows more contact between the coaches and the student athletes outside of practice time. The NCAA has a bit more stricter mandates regarding how often a coach and a student athlete can get together. It's not so much in the NAIA. So our coaches act as mentors, tutors, advisors, academic advisors, and really help those student athletes along and talk to them about classes and do those checks. And it helps because we don't have the resources to hire other folks to do that for us. As far as eligibility goes, so the way a student athlete maintains eligibility so that they can perform in intercollegiate athletics, for us and for most of the schools, it begins with a compliance officer. And for us, our compliance officer is also our women's basketball coach. And that compliance officer delivers a list of student athletes to our registrar. And that list of student athletes is those student athletes who are going to be competing that term. The registrar then takes that list of student athletes and pulls up all of the transcripts on those student athletes to evaluate those transcripts for a couple of things. Number one is grade point average, to make sure they have a grade point average that it's at least a 2.0 or above, that they are enrolled full-time in classes, and our student athletes have to be enrolled full-time all year long, that they are showing progress towards a major, that they can't just take classes to be eligible, that they're actually declared a major and they move toward a major in those classes. And that they cannot repeat any classes just for eligibility's sake. They can repeat classes to get a better grade if they want to later on, but it does not count towards eligibility. So our registrar evaluates the transcripts there. This process is overseen by our faculty athletic rep, and also called the FAR. And the faculty athletic rep is a full-time faculty member that is assigned by the faculty senate and the president to ensure the integrity of this process. He will audit the registrar's handiwork to make sure that it is adequate and good. Then I will sign that paperwork along with the FAR and the head coach, and then that paperwork is delivered to the NAIA national office, declaring that these student athletes are indeed eligible to compete in that season of competition.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Yes. Can I just butt in? The FAR is a requirement of the NAIA, so every NAIA school will have one.
Representative Denver, yes.
And is there something comparable for the NCAA schools?
Yes.
Thank you.
Same thing, yes.
Yes.
you know, another shifting gears as far as support goes for our student athletes, the NAI and my colleague Mike Schell from OIT talked about it a little bit, but the NAI really focuses on the promotion of what they call the champions of character, and it is intentionally teaching character values to our student athletes. That old adage about character is taught by sports is not necessarily true unless you intentionally teach it as a coach and administrators and make sure that those student athletes understand what it is, and those values of integrity, respect, responsibility, servant leadership, and sportsmanship, that they understand those values and how they relate to being a teammate and an athlete. We take them all pretty seriously at SOU, and they're very gratifying for us. The one that we really hang our hats on is our servant leadership. We ask all of our student athletes to contribute 10 hours of community service each year, which most of them do a lot more than that. So if you've got 400 student athletes, you've got 4,000 hours of community service in the Rogue Valley and on our campus. And so we're pretty proud of our student athletes for that. And employers know that we ingrain those values in our student athletes and look for those civic values of meritocracy and servant leadership and productive interracial cooperation, teamwork. So we get a lot of calls from employers looking for student athletes. It's also gratifying in unexpected ways, and I'll leave you with this story. Our football team made it to the quarterfinal rounds of the national playoffs this year. We have a playoff system, unlike the Division I's that have a bowl system. We have a playoff system, so it's pretty exciting for us. And we were back in Iowa taking on St. Ambrose, and we beat them. And we're coming back through the airport in Iowa City. And the football team and the coaches were going through the security checkpoint, and I was kind of hanging back, checking my phone. and a TSA agent came up to me and said, are you in charge of these young men? And I thought about my answer. but I did say yes. Those are my boys. And they said, well, that's the nicest, most respectful, well-mannered group of young men we've ever had come through here. Every time I say that, I get a little choked up. But that's so meaningful to an athletic director. We've just won a football game in the national playoffs, and to have a TSA agent come up to you and say, that's a great group of young men, very gratifying. Of course, asked, where are you guys from again? And we get to say Oregon, Southern Oregon. So it's a support system that we provide to our student athletes that we take a lot of pride in as well. Thanks.
Thank you very much,
Matt. You wait till the end of the panel?
Yeah, why don't we? Okay, Matt, welcome. Before you start, I just want to say, I first heard Matt speak, speak at a Ways and Means Roadshow in Portland, and I immediately texted Debbie Koreski, we need this guy to come in and talk to us. So, welcome.
Representative Dembro, member of the committee, thank you for asking me to come here. And she told me that story, and I thought, she said, you thought you were funny and fun, and you were good. And so I got a little more nervous this time. Just
yeah, you weren't that good. No.
Well, it was funny, too, because then they sent out an email that said Drew Huebel was coming. He was my backup. So I was a little bit, I was like, well, now they're calling for Drew Huebel. And so that was funny. But that made me, anyways. So Drew Huebel, I just tell you, it made me think of when he said football players, you know, they scare him a little bit. And but I'm proud to say that Drew is one of my best friends. And he actually is a police officer in Pendleton. Just was hired. The quarterback before me has just finished his getting his doctorate at OHSU, becoming a doctor. And the quarterback after me, Connor Kavanaugh, is now a financial advisor. And then myself, mm-hmm. I am working at Portland State as a director of annual giving. So very proud of my quarterback fraternity while I was in school. So I'm here to talk about the impact of athletics on my life and what it's like to be a student athlete while you're in school. I grew up in a small town in Washington, a small logging town, and I've told that story before, so I won't say it again, but I was a quarterback, I played basketball, I played baseball, and I really wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to a four-year university without a scholarship, whether it was athletic, academic. I wouldn't have had that opportunity. So I was offered a full scholarship at Portland State, and it was my only football scholarship offered, so I chose Portland State. And at first I wanted to be an engineering student because I had an aunt who was an engineer at Boeing, and my dad was a welder, my mom was an assistant at a community college, and I didn't really know anything else other than, my aunt's an engineer, I want to be an engineer. So I really, that cultural capital I wasn't really blessed with as far as what I wanted to do. So when I got to Portland State, I found out that there are other things. I took an engineering class, and I thought, this is not for me. And I was on a WUI scholarship, so I only had to choose between certain majors, and so I called my aunt and said, well, I guess I'm going to be a sociology major, Aunt Sue, because that was one of the only ones that was available, and she said, no, I've never hired a sociology major in my life, and she goes, do you even know what that is? And I said, well, I like people, and so that's kind of fun, but so I chose to be get my business degree, and graduating with that, I was very thankful, and luckily, it was one of the better business degrees that you could have got. I then went to University of Washington, received my master's degree in intercollegiate athletics leadership, a special program up there, and then came right back and started as the director of annual giving, raising funds for scholarships at Portland State and for our student athletes. And so, without a scholarship in athletics, I don't know where I would have been. I would have probably attended a community college back home, and I'm not sure where I would have gone. So, one, I'm staying in athletics. I love my position where I'm at now, and I wouldn't have been. I wouldn't be where I'm at without it. Yeah. Typical day. I'll start by saying, after 2 years in college, Jerry Glanville was my head coach, and he came from Hawaii. And there's always several stories about Jerry and how unique he was. But one thing he did, probably the worst thing he did, and why we never really won with him, was we practiced at 7 a.m. So that's where my day started out. I'd wake up at 5:30 and we'd go to practice. We'd start at 6 a.m. And after, you think late October, early November, it's pouring down rain. It's 30 degrees out, 40 degrees outside. Mouse Davis is 80 years old, and he's all bundled up, and he can't can't even talk because he's so freezing, and he's supposed to be our office coordinator. So I think the reason we still haven't won as much as we should have is I think the kids are still tired from that experience. But so we started, my day would start at 5:30, and I would go to practice. Then afterwards, there's always mandatory study hall for several of the student athletes. Practice is about 3 hours, and then there was always mandatory weight room during the season. The training room, as you know, student athletes are always physically exhausted or injured with all their sports. Obviously, I always took night classes, but it really became a day of, it was 5:30 to 8 every day on campus. I served as a student ambassador on campus, so I was in a leadership position with a student leadership group. So it really is a full-time job. And so I think, especially with Portland State, that it's traditionally a commuter school, the student athletes, we have 350 or so on campus, are really a consistent on-campus community that people see. They know who they are. They're wearing sweatpants. They got ice bags around their knees or shoulders. And so it represents a community on campus, and as well as, it's something that they do full-time. They learn a lot of things. Some of those things are competitiveness, excellence, perfection. And perfection, I think, is something that's very unique to a student athlete. And obviously nobody's perfect, but I think if you ever wanted a great experience, it's going to a basketball practice a meeting or a football meeting and watching those teams watch film. I mean, it's something that if you saw Miles Davis go through hours and hours of film every day saying, I think you need to set, your foot needs to be, 3 inches to the right here, or, a right tackle, his hand needs to be a little bit further up on his shoulder pad. I mean, it's a game of inches, and the hours of film they put in and the perfection that they're graded upon is different than anything else. Perseverance, hard work, time management, all those things. And I think another thing that student athletes learn is, like I talked about, the physical exhaustion of athletics, but it's also the mental. There's a lot of things, there's a lot of different ways to learn in college, through the academics. But I think what student athletes go through is finishing a practice at 10 a.m. and being physically exhausted, mentally exhausted, you're coached upon perfection, and then going into a class and starting to focus on, an accounting class, and then going from there to study hall and then a training room, and then going to a meeting and being graded back on football, and then going back to study. I mean, I think there's just several different tasks, and you're emotionally and physically drained every day. And so, I mean, not everybody is a great egg, but I think that it's different. It's very different than anybody else. At Portland State, we had study hall monitors. We had academic advisors, 3 or 4 of those. We have a program called GPS Life Skills, where we have somebody who oversees a program to train our student athletes on several different whether it's how to build credit, how to do cook. We have several different classes. We try to bring in some different leaders in the community to bring in. We have some tutors for our chemistry classes and some math classes and things like that. And something we've been trying to get into soon is start doing vocational testing and seeing if we can start getting student athletes to fully buy into what they want to do with their lives. So I think some of the opportunities that student athletes are presented with are pretty abundant, as far as traveling all over the country, food, and you develop a network of friends. I have friends who are farmers. I have friends that are police officers, firefighters, doctors, financial advisors, teachers, dentists, all over this West Coast now. And I think it's something that it provides student athletes have that unique touch on all the communities. So thank you very much, and open to questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, all three of you. Rep Greenland.
Thank you. I wonder if I could ask you how you think the Rooney Rule has been working at Southern and others of your colleagues when you talk to them. How's it going?
Yeah, Representative Dembro and Representative Greenlake, we have not had a real opportunity to explore that right when I was hired, actually. The Rooney Rule came up right after that. So talking with my colleagues, they are very aware of it. I think we make a concerted effort to seek out candidates of color and actually candidates of both sex for programs as well. So I think my colleagues around the state do a very good job of being aware of it and attempting to bring in those candidates with the rule or without the rule, actually.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rep. Greenlake. Rep. Gallegos.
I just want to follow up on that a little bit.
I was thinking about the admissions numbers, and I've also been suggested to me that the increase in numbers has a lot to do with the economy, and so, you know, a lot of students going to school now. But my affiliation is at the University of Portland, and I've had, obviously we have the girls' soccer team, women's soccer team, excuse me, and
is this a
number of my students actually go on to the Olympics, U.S. Olympic team, and now we've got the professional team in Portland. So it's been my pleasure, really, to have a lot of those young women in my classes, and actually Samantha sort of made me think about, I actually had a female basketball player from Colville Reservation. Might have been your mother. I don't know. But you know, I guess it is similar concern. I mean, I don't want to, you know, shout out the University of Portland in particular, because I think it's a universal issue that there seems to be a disproportionate number of students of color on particular sports. And, I mean, how do you respond to that? I mean, you just said that you're making an effort, but mm-hmm. you know, disproportionate number of students of color on these teams as opposed to the general population and the student body. And is that's continuing, and so maybe you could talk about how we're dealing with that?
Sure, Representative Dembro and Representative Gallego. So I'll talk to the athletic side. My colleague can probably talk to the admissions side. But the diversity at SOU, a lot of it has to do with our athletic programs. Half of the African Americans on campus are student athletes. So we take a lot of pride in that. And I think the institution sees the value in athletics that brings that diversity to campus. Otherwise, Little Ashland might not see students of color in that amount. So we're pretty proud of that, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Chair Dembro and Representative Gallegos, diversity is one of our primary goals at the University of Oregon. Our freshman class in the fall of 2012 was 25% domestic minority and 10% international. So over a third of the entering freshman class at the University of Oregon either came from a traditionally underrepresented population or from one of 88 countries around the world. That brings great value to all of our students, but particularly students that come from parts of Oregon where it may not be quite as diverse. So it's a priority for us, and knock on wood, I think our freshman 2013 class will show even more growth in terms of domestic minority students at the U of O. So our students are going to have to compete in a global economy in the 21st century, and so it's really important, I think, to expose students to kids that are different and have had different experiences than what they've grown up with. So at least on our campus, we've got 20,000 undergraduates. We're proud of the diversity that's there, and it certainly goes well beyond athletics. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for that question, Rep. Gallegos. Rep. Gorsuch.
I went to both schools. Sorry. I mean, Southern's great, too. But so I don't know which one to ask first. But let me ask the Portland State gentleman one question. We heard from, I think, both of the other two gentlemen that there's a pretty high standard in terms of academics. Would you say that was your experience also at Portland State in terms of the level that the players achieve?
Yeah, I think I brought a stat, and you know, our GPAs and our grad rates are much higher than the general population of the university. In the last 3 years, we had 60 all-conference academic honors in 2000. I think it was 10. That was 3 years ago, and then it was around 72, and now it's at 88 in the last fiscal year 12. So we've seen it increase. You know, Portland State is traditionally a commuter school, and right. and so, you know, it's one of our access, but I think our student athletes, one, because of the NCAA rules, are held to a certain standard. But I think I don't remember this by heart, but I think our leading major for women are business, our leading major for men is criminology and criminal justice, which is, you know, I was surprised to hear that.
You knew that was his.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, we set this up, Mitch, but
no. For the public, that's Rep Gorsuch. That's what he teaches.
Okay. So I think I was surprised to hear that, and which was great. So I would say so.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So basically, what happens then is that there's, I think, kind of a disconnect between the general public's old idea of kind of the, you know, not so academically inclined jock, and what we see today, which is a real strong emphasis on education.
I think the public scrutiny is probably, I think it's probably a response to that. I think in the last 10 years, the NCAA, as well as the universities, have said we cannot have that that traditional jock perception last. So I think there's been a response to say from the NCAA with APR laws, which is your academic progress rate and progress towards degree rule policies that say you need to achieve at a certain level, you need to have, you know, be accomplishing this many credits towards a degree at this time of year, at this time of whether you're a sophomore or junior. And so I think that response, we're starting to see some of the outcomes of that. So,
you know, I might add from our perspective, Chair Dembro and Rep Gorsuch, you know, I think one of the unfortunate things that happens in society is you may have one student athlete that really doesn't do very well in whatever regard in life, and that is sort of the front page of the Oregonian.
Right.
And when in fact we have hundreds of student athletes. Our program at U of O is the Oregon Heroes program that go into kids' schools and tutor and mentor and do wonderful things. And I think because there's a section of the paper dedicated to sports, we read about the outliers as opposed to the vast majority of young people who come to the University of Oregon. They're not going to go on to professional careers in athletics, at least in a performance kind of way. And they graduate with degrees and they do wonderful things. You know, I joke about a young man who was a running back for us this last year, you can figure out who that is, that got drafted in the NFL, and no one mentioned that he graduated with two majors. That doesn't make it in the story. Right. And so I think if you had the opportunity, if all of you did, to work with some of the young people that come through our athletic program, you'd really be proud of the character and the dedication. As was highlighted, these students are working in school with great opportunities and education for much lower cost than the average kid's going to pay. And they get a great opportunity and they take full advantage of it. And I wish we had more stories about the Jordan Hassays working with young kids in Eugene as opposed to just how well she runs the 5,000 meters.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Oh, and if I could just really quick, the one thing you forgot about U of O that could attract people to the U, you forgot Donald.
Yeah.
Now, I know everybody calls it Puddles. No, that's wrong. That's Donald. And I think Donald brings people in. I've seen Donald on ESPN. I mean,
I don't disagree. I just received a picture from a family in Disneyland where Donald was doing the O because he saw their shirt. Perfect. So I don't disagree.
Thank you. One last question, Rip Greenlee.
More of a comment. Mr. Holder, I played a little bit of football until I figured out those guys on the other side of the line were trying to hurt me. And so I understand what you're talking about. But I also ended up the last three years of my program working 40 hours a week and being a full-time student. I just want to point out there are others that it's good to compare that burden with because they drag around sleep-deprived as the athletes do in the same way from that life. And I taught at Portland State for many years, and I introduced sociology of sport. I was the first one in the state to teach it at probably 1972 or something, before there were hard textbooks you had to
use. Again, 72.
And the athletes would show up in this class thinking it was about sports rather than about sociology. They got a little shocked. But they were great kids. I mean, it was really fun teaching teaching these kids once they figured out this was a real class.
So. I didn't realize they had sociology back then, but
sociology had just been invented in 72.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, all three of you, for being here.
Thank you.
And going to call up our last panel, Brent Wilder, David Rigsby. We hear now from the independent colleges. Colleagues, we were also hoping to have someone from the community colleges as well. Community colleges do have, obviously, a vibrant, but they, but the person who was going to come had a death in the family and had to cancel. But gentlemen, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Dembro, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here and talking to you a little bit about intercollegiate athletics and the role it plays with the independent colleges here in Oregon. My name is Brent Wilder. I'm the vice president for the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. And what I'm going to do is just give you a little bit of an overview as to how many institutions here in Oregon sponsor intercollegiate athletics, a little bit about some of the financials, and I'll let my colleague go in a little bit more detail about the specific experience at Willamette University. Currently, of the 19 Alliance member institutions, 11 sponsor intercollegiate athletics. The University of Portland is a member of the West Coast Conference. They compete at the NCAA Division I non-football level. We have five members that compete at the NCAA Division III level, which is the Northwest Conference. NCAA Division III is those student athletes do not receive any athletic student aid. And we have four institutions that compete at the NAI level in the Cascade Conference. That is Warner Pacific, Northwest Christian, Concordia University, and Corbin University. And then we also have one institution, Multnomah University, competes in the National College Collegiate Athletic Association. So we have 11 that offer sports at the intercollegiate athletic level. I would also say that I can generally, I think if I had to encompass the intercollegiate athletics at our institutions, they are fully integrated into the overall mission of the institution. If I had to say what that would be, I said the mission of intercollegiate athletics is to bring students, faculty, staff, alumni together in educational activities that promote healthy lifestyles, enhance a sense of community, foster growth in leadership and teamwork skills, and encourage the pursuit of excellence. So regardless of the level that these institutions are competing at, they're all pursuing excellence, and it's fully a co-curricular type of activity within their educational experience. Students participating in intercollegiate athletics represent approximately 14% of the total undergraduate enrollment of our institutions. On average, the students that are participating in intercollegiate athletics at our 11 institutions that offer intercollegiate athletics represents anywhere from 20 to 30% of the undergraduate enrollment. So it's a significant enrollment management strategy at our institutions that offer intercollegiate athletics. The average annual institutional salary per head coach at our 11 institutions is $26,000. The average annual institutional salary per assistant coach is $5,800. Total athletic-related student aid, and again, that's not including the members of the Northwest Conference at the Division III level, but that's $9 million total. And I would venture to say probably most of that would be at the University of Portland, who is competing at the Division I level.
Now, Mr. Wilder, you do know we have minimum wage laws in the state.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Different
committee.
But again, I think that's representative of the coaches that are working at our institutions do it because they view themselves as teachers and having an impact in the, you know, in the lives of student athletes at our institutions. The collective total recruiting budgets of all 11 institutions is $475,000. And total revenues and expenses at all 11 are somewhere in the neighborhood of $34 million. And that's collectively our 19 institutions represent a budget of $770 billion. So you see it's a fairly small fraction of the overall budget. I just want to share one final story as I close and allow Mr. Grigsby to share his thoughts. Many of you may or may not realize that Linfield College won the Division III National Baseball Championship earlier this week.
Yes, we heard about it on the floor.
No, okay. Well, I apologize for repeating it. But again, it's a great example of what the student-athlete experience is at our institutions. Of the 25-man roster, 14 of those student-athletes are from Oregon. They're led by Scott Brocious, who's our head coach. Scott is a Linfield graduate. Played 11 years in the major leagues. Was the MVP of the World Series with the Yankees in 1998. And when Scott retired, he came back, finished up his degree at Linfield in 2002, and chose to live in McMinnville. And because of his experience as a student athlete at Linfield, that servant leadership aspect of it of his experience continued on, and he wanted to live in Oregon and decide what he wanted to do. It was what was best for his family, and he decided to get into coaching and did so at Linfield, and has been the head coach there for 6 years. And again, I think that's a very typical experience that you would see from a student athlete and a coach and administrator at an institution at one of our here in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gembro and the committee, thank you. My name is Dave Rigsby. I'm the Director of Athletics and also Associate Dean of Campus Life at Willamette University. To start, I guess I'll give a brief synopsis of my story, because in fact it ties very closely into the testimony we've heard today. I was a small college recruited student athlete to Willamette in the mid-90s. I was recruited to play baseball, ironically to be a closer, which I will do here today, which means I can go on as long as and thank goodness I did not have to face Scott Brocious.
Only 30 pitches.
But again, I was recruited to play baseball, and after a series of injuries, I was not able to play anymore. So sports got me to college, but again, the faculty, the classes, the amazing campus life at Willamette University kept me there and on pace to graduate in 4 years, a four-year graduation rate that's pretty common in most of our small private independent colleges. I was able to come full circle, come back to Willamette several years ago, and 2 years ago to serve as athletic director. And again, for me, it was a coming home, back to an experience that was so profound as an undergraduate, even though it was cut short by injury. And in fact, again, today, this hearing is a sort of coming home for me as an undergraduate student in Willamette. I was an education policy advisor and intern for Governor Kitzhaber and his last administration. Probably would have been taking notes in this meeting had I been able to. So again, many close connections to, again, the work that we're doing here today. So what do we know about Division III? And I think in particular, what do most people in the world know about Division III? As my colleague indicated, most people know that Division III is a division that doesn't offer athletic scholarships, right? In fact, it's the division where all of your financial aid is academic or need-based aid. So again, very distinctive about the Division III experience. Others know about Division III by what they read in the sports page. And again, if you live in the I-5 corridor between, really, you know, Eugene and Corvallis and Portland, you'll read about the rivalries. You'll read about Willamette and Linfield. You'll see a box score. You'll read that Michaela Freebie, our sophomore runner from the Portland area, finished fourth in the 3,000-meter steeplechase last week. Those are stories, again, that I think most sports fans will, in fact, understand because they're significant. They're meaningful if you follow sports. The problem, however, I think my colleague from University of Oregon shared this earlier, a lot of what's not told should actually be on the front page. And I think that Division III is, I would call it the front page division. And then I'll share two stories about that I think underscore what Division III is all about. First is about Jayla Dinsmore. And Jayla is a 2012 graduate of Willamette University. She attended Burns High School here in Oregon. Great, great student. You know, she was a 3.99 student at Willamette. She was summa cum laude of her class. She was Phi Beta Kappa. I mean, all these things were distinctive. At the conclusion of her career at Willamette, she received a prestigious Fulbright grant to study and teach in Columbia. And oh, by the way, she finished fifth in the 100 meters at the 2012 NCAA Division III track championships. She's in the top 10 record books in the 100 and the 200 at Willamette. Very talented student athlete, received the NCAA Elite 89 award for the highest GPA of a student competing in a national championship. So again, a story in my mind should be on the front page and not in the sports page. Another story, again, a story about football and about the Willamette University football team. What, again, many people don't know is that the Willamette football team cancels one day of fall practice every year to serve in this community. And again, among the places they serve is the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Center. About a year ago, or a year and a half ago, as floodwaters ravaged this community, the Women's Crisis Center was one of the places that was impacted. Well, who do you think they called? They called the Willamette football team. And so within an hour or two, that team, about two dozen members of the team, the coaches, they were there helping their community partner move in order to not be destroyed by, again, downtown Salem flooding. Again, a story, although a little bit about football, really is about a group of young men and women who, again, serve our community and serve it with distinction. Those are the stories I think that you'll hear about from all of our Division III schools, from Linfield, Pacific, George Fox, Lewis and Clark, and Willamette. We all have lots of those stories that, again, we're proud to share. We think they're front page stories, not sports page stories, but there's a lot of good stuff that's sports related too. These stories also illustrate the three principles of Division III. They are to discover. We ask that our student athletes discover their interests and passions beyond the classroom and the field of play. The college is a time for you to figure out who you're supposed to be, both in the now and in the future. A dad, husband, father, mother, sister, colleague, friend, All those things are important hallmarks of the Division III experience. To develop, we want you to develop into well-rounded adults. Our student athletes are encouraged to participate in multiple sports. They're encouraged to join clubs, to take on leadership roles, to join fraternities, sororities, campus government, student life government, all those things, a big part of your development as an undergraduate student. And lastly, to dedicate. Again, that you have to be dedicated to compete at this level. We heard this from two of the former student athletes that were here. It's no different in Division III. You have to truly balance a lot of competing demands for your time, and you have to do it with distinction. You have to be dedicated. And so again, to discover, to develop, and to dedicate. Those again are hallmarks of Division III. What else do we know? Well, Division III is that division, like I said earlier, that's about rewarding students at the point of entry for all those things they do that aren't sports-related, for their academic merit, for, again, their financial need. And as a result, lots of our student-athletes at our five Division III colleges in the state receive significant amounts of financial aid to attend our colleges. At Willamette, again, the phrase that many people use is the discount rate, the amount that we take off in financial aid to students, is about 50%. So again, on average, every student that comes to Willamette University receives about $25,000 a year in academic and business aid. That still leaves about $25,000 that most of these students and their families on average pay to attend these institutions. But again, it underscores the fact these are students first. They're students long before they're athletes. They go to class in order to compete. Many people have the misconception, though, that Division III isn't competitive. And in fact, you know, we have a joke that we have about Division III, and it's a joke that I would, if I don't give credit to our men's basketball coach, I'll get in trouble. But he's often joked that Division III students are sometimes 3 inches shorter, or they run 0.3 seconds slower, or maybe they pitch 3 miles per hour slower like I did, than their peers at scholarship schools. He also jokes that many of them earn 3 times the salary a few years later when they graduate. But again, I think that's overstating it a bit. But our students regularly compete and sometimes win when they are matched up against opponents in scholarship programs. Earlier this year, our tennis captain, Josh Wong, opened his season with a win against a Division I opponent at Portland State. Our track teams often compete against scholarship student athletes from Oregon State, and other schools throughout the state and region. And most of you probably know our most famous track alumnus, Nick Simmons, who was the fastest 800-meter runner at Willamette, won 7 NCAA Division III national championships long before he became a 2-time Olympian representing the state of Oregon in the United States of America. Again, this week, again, we heard the story about Linfield's baseball team. We have story after story after story among our five, again, Division III member schools about our students, our individuals and teams competing at the national level in football and baseball and softball and women's basketball, again, track and field. Again, we represent Oregon and the region with distinction at the national level. As Mr. Wilder commented earlier, there's lots of these students at our colleges. Roughly 25% of our students at all of our schools participate in student athletics, in varsity Division III student athletics. That's between 400 and 500 students on each of our campuses in about 20 sports. Again, there's a few schools that have 19 sports and a few schools that have for 20 to 22 sports. But again, we're on average 450 students in 20 sports at our member schools, and about 25% of the undergraduate student body are varsity Division III student athletes. But again, these are students that are students first. Again, they might miss on average in an individual season 3 or 4 days of class to travel. And again, their objective is to go to class, to be successful academically, and to be well-rounded citizens. Our schools are also finding more and more participation opportunities for our students. For example, in recent years, Lewis and Clark and Pacific brought back football to their campuses. George Fox will add it in 2014. Pacific will soon add women's rowing. Linfield has a young lacrosse program for women, and others will look to follow them with their own programs in a few years. For all of our schools, varsity athletic programs are important recruitment tools that help us enroll diverse and talented students from Oregon and throughout the nation. Again, that 25%, that's an important part of the sustainability of the financial model for Division III schools, because I'm going to go back to the fact that on average, those students are paying about $20,000 to $25,000 a year to attend those schools and in part to participate in varsity athletics. And what about the coaches? I mean, don't they aspire for bigger, better, and more? Again, some of our best coaches move on to positions at other institutions. Again, at Willamette, we're very proud of Dan Hawkins, who left Willamette after a successful career in the 90s, became a coach at Boise State in Colorado, and is now the head coach of the Montreal Alouettes in the CFL. But you'd also be surprised to learn how many coaches leave Division I, leave Division II, to come to Division III. At Willamette, we're blessed to have a longtime Big Ten Division I head coach for our women's volleyball team and Tom Shoji. Our brand new women's basketball coach came to Willamette after nearly two decades as a Division I assistant. Again, we talked about Scott Brocious at Linfield, again, a World Series MVP who came home to coach Linfield. Tim Cleary at Pacific was, again, one of the rising Division I basketball assistant coaches, again, doing great things there. Coaches choose Division III as well. It's not just the students. The coaches choose that. And why do they coach it? Well, they coach it because they see their roles as educators. They love the opportunity. They cherish it to teach students about all those lessons that, again, sports do a great job of teaching. So, again, a basketball coach cherishes the opportunity to teach about race and social class on a diverse team of basketball players. Again, great things that happen in settings like Willamette University. Alternatively, the lessons you learn about teamwork and leadership, they're a big part of what students learn in the classroom. So again, it's a very copacetic or intertwined experience for our student athletes.
Dave, if you could wind
up. I'm just finishing. So why doesn't everyone do it? Well, Division III athletics are tough. And, you know, first and foremost, we have high expectations for our students academically. You know, again, very rigorous education. It's hard for people to succeed at that level. Second, the athletic expectations are high. Again, we want people to do all those same things they do in other programs, the weight training, the yoga, the cardio, all those things, big part of what they do. And also in the Northwest Conference is tough. We're geographically isolated from the rest of the country. There's about two dozen Division III schools west of the Mississippi River in this country. There's over 400 of those schools east of the Mississippi River. Our teams have to travel far to represent Oregon, and they do it very well. So thank you. Appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much, Dave. Any quick questions?
I'd like to share a brief story about Willamette Athletics that Mr. Rigby may not know. The women's volleyball team, the mother of one of the players on the volleyball team was struck with lymphoma, blood cancer, and the team decided to honor her by raising money in a game and contributing it to lymphoma research, and they stumbled across me. I was president of the Lymphoma Research Foundation locally, and they made a contribution. We had a big ceremony, and then they came next year, early Sunday morning, driving from Salem to lead the lymphomathon and be the runs running off. We were very proud of them, and I think they had a great time at it. But you may not have heard that story.
I haven't. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Rep. Green. Rep. Gilhead.
Thank you.
That was thank you very much, comma, Rep. Greenlee. Oh, yeah. Now, pause, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you. Very nice. We don't have time for any more stories, but I want to whet the committee's appetite about one by asking David, where was the Willamette football team on December 7th, 1941?
It's a great story, Representative Gilliam. You know, the Willamette football team, again, December 7, 1941, was in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And again, you can Google this afterwards, but again, ESPN, NFL Films, a great story about our football team serving for about 7 days in Hawaii. The men on that trip were surrounded Punahou School. Again, the school that later educated Barack Obama. The women on that trip, the moms, the girlfriends, the wives, they all volunteered as nurses, again, for about a week serving our country. So, again, one of the great stories about Willamette in Oregon that is well worth the 10 minutes if you Google it. So.
Okay, I don't think we could top that one.
Yeah.
So. Thank you very much,
you.
Both of you, and everyone who came today. This was a great overview of athletics. We may well want to delve into different particular aspects in future hearings during the interim, you know, certainly I'm open to any suggestions there. Thank you very much. And before I close, so one of the areas that I would like to get more information on, this is to you, Mike Schell, is, you know, we had the presentation on the revenue, the different revenue sources. It would be useful, I think, to get the various expenditure category. You don't need to do this today, but just it would be useful to see just, you know, the money that's coming into athletics, you know, how much is going out to scholarships, how much is going to coaches' salaries, how much is going to this, that, et cetera.
We can. Very well. I'll provide that.
Great. Thank you.
And check out minimum wage laws, huh?
That's right. Okay. With that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on athletics. Colleagues, members of the audience, have a great weekend. See you Monday.